So these are some comments on Malcolm X's, primarily on his message to the grassroots. It won't take very long. I think, as Malcolm himself says at the beginning, you know, let's speak in words that everyone can comprehend. And I think he does that. Everybody can comprehend Malcolm X. So what I want to do is to just, I guess, summarize and crystallize and focus a couple of the things he's getting at. And specifically what I want to get at is the way in which, though Malcolm is talking about black people, I hear him, and I'm a white dude, I hear him offering a strategy and a set of concerns and realizations that I find extremely valuable, even from my perspective. So these things are about unification, about how to form groups, and about how to struggle, and then about what are the obstacles to the formation of groups, what are the obstacles to struggle, or in this case, more specifically, what are tactics of struggle, which probably they're definitely more dominant than they ought to be. Here he's talking about nonviolence. This is a tactic that he disagrees with. So I'm just going to list through these things, and then I'll conclude by saying how I think Malcolm's recommendations can be generalized, and what kind of a model he gives us that we might use in order to think about organizing. So first, thoughts on unification. How do a people become unified? On what basis is the unity of a population possible? We have very direct answers here. First of all, people are unified or can be unified. They can find commonality insofar as they have things in common. Now, what are the things in common? I think there are two distinct things, although they overlap in this case. One is that a group of people can form a real unity. It's like a group of people is a potential group insofar as that group, each of the individuals in that group, has somehow gone through a shared experience. So black people in the United States, whether they know one another or not, whether they have the same preferences in other aspects of their life or not, have some commonality insofar as, whether they like it or not, they're going to get treated in this particular American racist way. Black people have a shared experience. And this is the period in Malcolm's career when he is really starting to think more broadly than the American black struggle. And he's starting to see that this having of a common experience extends beyond black people as well and includes black and brown people all over the world. So this moves to the next basis for commonality. It's linked in this case, but I think it's a distinct thing. A group is a group. It can be a real group, and it has perhaps a shared interest, and it can act together insofar as that group has a common enemy. So in this picture, Malcolm is talking about a pan-African or even a global anti-imperialist, anti-colonial, decolonial perspective where he can understand the circumstance of black folks, Native American people, Latinx folks, women, he doesn't say women, and then colonized Africans, colonized Asians, colonized Latin Americans, all as they're unified. They could be unified. They could form an undefeatable block of people because on the basis of a unity that has to do with sharing a common enemy. And then what's the last thing maybe to be said about forming unities? Well, that within a unity, within a group, And that's what Malcolm is thinking about. He's thinking about building power through the building of groups which understand themselves, understand who is their enemy, are ready to advance their interest, and defend their community. That's what he's thinking about. Within such groups, there should be an ethic of nonviolence. There should be an openness and a willingness to talk through differences like brothers or family, he says. But outwardly, that nonviolence thing is going to be a problem. Now, before we move on to that, let's talk about what are the threats to unity, which means what are the things that divide a community, and specifically, what are the things that divide the Black American community? Here's where he goes into this famous and very pushy, very striking distinction between house slaves and field slaves. And the whole point of this metaphor, of course, is to say that those roles which existed in the period of American slavery and Caribbean slavery, those roles still exist in some sense. You know, Malcolm famously refers to Martin Luther King as Uncle Martin, implying that he is an Uncle Tom. So what's the difference between these positions? That, you know, that it's not just about slavery, right? It's about domination, and it's about the question of the relationship between the dominated and the dominator. What's the difference? The difference is that the house slave understands the good of the master as his good as well. This is a threat to the community, right? People who don't identify with those who undergo the same thing and don't recognize who their enemy really is, people who, because of some kind of privilege and or some kind of cowardice, and they seem on this analysis to go together, they identify their good with the enemy itself, with the master. That's the problem with the house slave, right? The house slave lived better. House slave was a minority, lived better than the field slaves, got to wear the master's old clothes, carried out, you know, festivities that imitated European high culture. They did the dances of their masters. And what Malcolm points at, they use the word we, but when they say we, they mean them and the master. Them and the master's family. Now, they live in the basement or they live in the attic. They don't really get to live like the master. They're not really recognized as human beings, but they certainly are treated better than the field slaves. They come to identify themselves with the master. They say we to mean they and the masters. And I think the basic word that Malcolm doesn't quite use here, he calls them Uncle Toms, which is harsh enough, but they're traitors. They're traitors to the group. At best, they are confused. At worst, they have sold out. At any rate, help for the community is not to be found with them. On the other hand, there are the field slaves. And the distinction here, and Malcolm says he's a field slave, right? Like Martin is a house slave, at least when Malcolm is pissed off at him. But Malcolm himself identifies with the perspective of the field slaves specifically because he hates the master. He thinks that the field slaves, who were the majority, kept their senses about them. I mean, it was easier for them to know who was the enemy because they were the ones being beaten every day, right? But they did not get confused about who we was. They did not mistakenly identify themselves with the dominating power. Instead, they recognized that the dominating power was the master, and that the master, in order for them to be free, in order for them to live better, it'd be good if the master got sick and died or if somebody killed him. They kept their senses about them. They did not run away from conflict. They did not confuse themselves about who their real people were. Okay, next, how to struggle. What does he tell us in this text about how to struggle? He says specifically, you know, here he's distinguishing between what he calls the Black Revolution and the Negro Revolution. And he thinks that word Negro is an ugly term that is given to Black people by white people. And he thinks that Black or African American or Afro American are better terms because they are given to Black people by Black people. And I use that term because the majority of people that I know and respect who are African American or Black or whatever, they say Black. So what would Black Revolution look like? He's like, okay, we got to talk about real revolution, and we should be careful not to get confused about that term. When you have a bunch of people protesting and asking white society please to accept them, that's not a revolution. A revolution aims at land. It wants space. It wants territorial control. And on his understanding, territorial control in which to build a nation, in which to build some kind of social unity, which is for the good of all the people involved in that unity. Shoot for land. And then there's something about strategy and tactics here. It's rarely the case, and in the examples he gives, never the case, maybe it's never the case in general, that the most radical leadership comes from a privileged sector or even from the people who are recognized as leaders. Those photogenic people who are the best known in society are never the most radical people. And often, even if they speak in a fiery language, they don't really have the goal of agitating and exciting the masses to take the streets and take the territory by force, which is the only way in which they're going to get it, as far as he understands. Where does that kind of energy come from? It comes from the bottom. Now, there may be leaders among those at the bottom. There may be special individuals or specially placed individuals, but maybe not. Maybe there's just a whole bunch of individuals who are really suffering so much that they're perfectly aware what their conditions are, therefore are perfectly aware who their enemy is, therefore are perfectly aware who we is, and because of that condition at the bottom, are also perfectly aware of the violence and the force that will be necessary in order really to liberate themselves. So this is why the text is called Message to the Grassroots, right? These are the grassroots. The grassroots, in this case, are the easiest thing. Angry young black people in 1968, not their leaders on television, not the ones who are linking arms and singing songs, right? You know what Malcolm says in this tradition of preachers? You know, in a revolution, there is no singing because you're too busy swinging. Okay, what is the obstacle to real struggle? The obstacle, or an obstacle, the key obstacle at the time when Malcolm writes this, or gives this speech rather, is the nonviolent, assimilationist, integration-oriented, political rights-oriented civil rights movement, which focused on nonviolence. Nonviolence is the problem. And, you know, I know somebody who's part of the Black Panthers, and he said this was the speech that changed his mind. He came back from Vietnam. He hadn't been politicized before. He fought in Vietnam. He was decorated in Vietnam, came back, and he heard this speech, and he said it made him ashamed. And what Malcolm says is, you know, you bleed for white people. You bleed in Korea for white people. You kill other darker people because white people tell you to. You're not nonviolent over there, but then you come home and the white people tell you to be nonviolent and you're nonviolent here. Your priorities are messed up, right? So the problem is this insistence upon nonviolence. Malcolm is dismayed. He's pissed off that those who speak the language of nonviolence also use terms like revolution. He's like, you want one or you want the other, but you cannot have both because revolutions use force. And nonviolence, okay, maybe it's a tactic that could work in certain circumstances, but it is not working here. And then there's a way, I suppose, in which this story about the civil rights movement and this concern about what unifies or divides an oppositional community shows up again, where he gives this story about the Big Six at the end of his speech. His point is that you shouldn't trust those who are at the top. You shouldn't trust the big names who show up on the television or at the front of the congregation or at the front of the rally, and they take the stage and they say fancy things and they're very well dressed and they seem very composed. Don't trust those people, because oftentimes those people are put where they are by the power establishment, which actually wants to divide and keep the black community down. So he shows how white interests funded, organized, and he thinks controlled actors like Martin Luther King. Okay, so this is the picture. You should be militant. You should be from the bottom up. And my feeling in reading this stuff, the reason I give this to class after class to read, is because I think there are rules in here, there are principles for organizing, for militant and revolutionary organizing, that are still applicable and are applicable whether you're black or not. So rule number one, find commonality. We build groups by finding commonality. We can find commonality on the basis of shared experiences, on the basis of common enemies. Secondly, we should seek to control space and land. At least that's, you know, that's what he defines as revolutionary, and that's what he wants. You have to organize from the bottom up. It's the message to the grassroots, right? You have to trust the people who are themselves affected by conditions to have the capacity to organize themselves and figure out what actions are necessary. And then, like Kwame Ture and Charles Hamilton in Black Power, the interest is in self-determination. Any of these groups which are based upon commonality, and which will, by the way, increase their commonality, increase their power as a group by acting, maybe that's a third type of commonality, maybe the most powerful one, what these groups should aim at is political and economic self-determination. That's what will become by 1968. That's what will become Black Power. That's what Malcolm is interested in. And then the last thing, you know, he's at this point, he's coming back from Africa. He has already started thinking about the struggle of black folks in the United States in a global imperial and anti-imperial context. And he's already thinking about, you know, this question about what does he think about, you know, communist China, for example? And his answer is very calm and considered. And it is that, well, it's really good that there are power centers other than the United States on the face of the earth, because those power centers push on the United States. And when external force operates upon this nation, that's the circumstance where it is more likely, most likely, to flex and change internally. So if I was to generalize this rule, you should think about our context, your context, the groups that you are a part of, the people with whom you have commonality, who might form a group and might aim at self-determination and self-improvement as you determine it. As you think about your circumstance, you should also think about the big picture. Think about local contexts in contact with bigger contexts.